So I came prepared today to talk about what's called 10 paramis. And sometimes they're translated as 10 perfections, and sometimes they're referred to as paramitas, much more so in Mahayana tradition, and even which part of it is a Zen tradition, we use the word paramita more than parami. And I thought today I would introduce the 10 paramis, and they are an incredibly important part of Buddhist teachings. And from what I learned and what the teachings say is they define inner strengths that one can cultivate through Buddhist practice. The core, I call it, the Buddhist practice is emphasizing solid character and presence we bring to every life situation. And there are 10 of them, like I said. And I wanted to give introduction to these 10 today, and over the course of time, maybe in the next 12 months or so, I do plan to go into each one of them in more detail, what it takes and what it means, as well as how we cultivate that particular parami. And coincidentally, Gil offers a beautiful course called Anukampa Program. I think it's scheduled to start next month, August, I think. It's offered by Sati Center. It's a 10, 11-month program. And it's really cultivating a caring heart is the theme of the program. And what they do over the 11 months or each month is go through one parami. And that exercise involves writing reflections and contemplation and a lot of intergroup discussions and sharing, a lot of them. And it's beautiful, beautiful course. And it's all on Zoom. So you don't even have to go to IMC for that. So the one, how I got drawn into the paramis is I studied Dhammapada, or at least that's a lofty claim. I'm continuing to study Dhammapada. That really emphasized just the right off the bat, the first two verses. Emphasize the power of the human mind shaping our lives and the importance and effectiveness of our own actions and choices. So there's no third party in this path. And exactly Gill's translation of first two verses say all experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind, speak or act with corrupted mind, and suffering follows, as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. And the core of Buddhist teaching, fundamentally, what I learned is that it's an inner strength we cultivate that really takes us to say we are our own protectors and shapers of our own destiny. And this particular comment is covered in the Dhammapada verse number 380. In a sense, what they're saying is what we do, especially with our mind and heart, determines our happiness of present and future or unhappiness. And each of us must make our own effort along the Buddhist path. Teachers can only show us the way. So ethical and mental purity, important ideals in Dhammapada, cannot be achieved through intervention of others, but by one's alone is purified. By one's effort alone, one is purified. That's verse 165. Any of you had a chance yesterday morning to listen to a discussion between Gill and Stephen Batchelor? Stephen Batchelor just wrote a book. It's not released yet. It's about Buddha, Pluto, and us. That's the title of the book. And the very first question of the discussion was around ethics, which is central to Buddhist teaching and not so much mentioned in Plato's teaching. And that's where they started to contrast the Greek teachings, Greek civilization to Buddhist civilization. I believe that recording is on Sati Center website. It's a beautiful discussion between two spiritual leaders coming from different angles, right? I totally enjoyed Watching that and the Q&A that followed. So the coming back to Paramis, the genesis of Paramis really is it started to pull together after Buddha passed. And what Gill says, well, I mean, again, I didn't mention this. I want to say a deep bows to Buddha and Gill as my teacher and the lineage of all the teachers all the way to Buddha of over 2,585 years. Deep bows to Dharma and deep bows to Sangha, right? That is the way we take refuge in, and that's how we engage. So Gill was mentioning as a notion of historical context of Paramis, this happened after Buddha passed, and monastics observed a certain group of people were attaining enlightenment sooner, stream enterers and beyond. And they really tried to profile what exactly is going on with these guys who are really finding this path easy to follow or quickly getting enlightened, or whatever phrases, terminology we can use to define that. And what they really assembled is a collection of 10 paramis, 10 perfections that was common to all these people who were able to get to that. And this is where, in the same teaching, Gill says, Buddhist practice is easy to understand, but difficult to do. Right. It, however, he emphasizes, which is rewarding for me to hear, is gradual growth and development or approach for all of us. And developing paramis makes going in the path much easier. So, in a sense, developing paramis basically means we are taking responsibilities and developing our qualities as we traverse this path. And there are many parts of Buddhism that can be intellectualized or grasped as knowledge. I know what the sutta says. I know what this teaching is. However, to be in the path requires the word is cultivating mind and heart together. And that's where paramis come. And the path is not about knowing as much as it is cultivating through deep reflection, contemplation, and practice. Yeah, we're going to go through the list, and the list by itself is not a rocket science, but we are going to go into cultivation over time. So what are those paramis? Like I said, there are 10. Generosity, in Pali, known as dana. Virtue, number two. Sila. Three, renunciation. Nekama. Four, wisdom. Panya. Five, energy and effort. Virya. Six, patience, or Kanti, Khanti. Seven, truthfulness, or Saccha, Sacca. And determination, Adithana. Loving kindness is number nine, metta. Number 10 is equanimity, Upekkha. So two of the Brahma Viharas made the top 10 list. Right? And we'll find out as we discuss more why the other two didn't make the list or why that is implicitly covered in others, right? So again, generosity, virtue, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, determination, loving kindness, and equanimity. Okay? Interestingly, Buddha did speak about all these 10 qualities across many of the discourses. So it's not like a random list that somebody compiled. Each one of these topics is covered in some part of the canon or some discourse or the other, right? We know that. Okay. However, as a list, it doesn't appear in any one of the major parts of the canon, Majjhima Nikaya. You can look at major Nikayas. However, it does appear in what's called Khudaka Nikaya, which is about 17 books in it. And one of them is essentially called Buddha Vamsa. And that's in that thing, there is a story called Story of Sumedha. And that's where, in that collection, in the Pali Canon, where this list of 10 paramis are listed in that order. So it's not like the Western world or anyone just quickly made it up. There is a authenticity behind how this list got formed and where it resides in the Pali However, right from the early days of Theravada Buddhism, which is what a lot of us practice here, paramis were viewed as essential elements on the path to Buddhahood and hence closely identified with the path of awakening. So what does it mean, right? The word essential elements of path to Buddhahood. So you almost want to realize, okay, I am here as a entity or in the dependent origination, we can use the link called becoming. And how does this paramis shape me in my practice so that I'm aligning the paramis cultivation of them with the singular purpose of self-knowledge as well as the path to awakening? So one thing that I learned going through this practice multiple times is each parami stands better as we are cultivating if it's brought in the context of compassion and wisdom. Compassion and wisdom, think of them as the land and water for the seed of parami to grow. So the idea behind that is it's not an intellectual understanding of what these paramis are and what the lists are. However, it's our understanding of applying the wisdom and compassion factors as we bring each parami and let it continue to unfold within us through our practice and essentially guide us towards the character. So just an aside, in Mahayana Buddhism, they cut it down to six paramis. 10 was too long, perhaps, I don't know. However, the philosophers in Mahayana tradition, largely from Nagarjuna and Shantideva, reduced the list from 10 to six. They took away five of the Theravadin paramis, namely renunciation, truthfulness, determination, loving kindness, and equanimity. They knocked off both the Brahma Viharas from this list. And they added one called concentration. So 10 minus 5 plus 1, they have six paramis. So the order is slightly different in Mahayana list, and this is generosity, virtue, the same two as the Theravadin list, and goes into patience, energy, concentration, and finally the wisdom. So I try to trace where how this comes in and where they were described in Mahayana. And my sources are, I'm still working on them, the three of them. One is the Nagarjuna's Middle Way. It's a beautiful treatise. And Shantideva's Bodhicharyavatara, which has been translated in so many ways, both from Tibetans and Westerners. It's such a beautiful, beautiful document that gives you a path to grow in the Buddhist lineage, or at least become a bodhicitta or bodhisattva, as I say. And that is explained in detail. In that path, they cover these six paramis. And the third one, of course, is the oral transmission of Manjushri. It's a document that really in Mahayana, it's very sacred, that came to effect somewhere around the fifth Dalai Lama. Right now we have the 14th Dalai Lama. And the current Dalai Lama wrote a huge volume of putting it writing what was historically been a oral transmission of Manjushri in writing as a book. And in that, he covers exactly the path of that Manjushri. Yeah, our oral transmission of Manjushri implicitly covers these six paramis. That's where the source of how these came in Mahayana tradition. So the other one is basically the question that I had was, so then they took away loving kindness and equanimity, and the Mahayanas in general talk about compassion a lot. Bodhisattva path and everything deals with compassion, and every second, third word of Dalai Lama is the word compassion. Why isn't there in the list? Right? And that answer was basically the compassion is what all the Paramis six together contribute. And that's how you go into Bodhisattva path. So Brahma Viharas is not implicit or explicit. Don't get into that. It is baked into every one of these six paramitas to be able to go through the path of Bodhisattvas. So now I want to go through each one of them briefly. There's a lot here, but we'll touch on it briefly today, and we'll have a chance to go into more detail subsequent meetings. The first one is generosity. Is there a reason why they are in that order? And Gill's teaching says, I believe so. Right? And we generally equate generosity to act of giving. But what Gill emphasized is this is one of the paramis where outside of us, a second entity is involved. So we are generous towards someone or something else. It is recognizing that our agency and what it can contribute in terms of value to others. And generosity, as we'll go into more detail, can be any number of things, starting from generosity of attention, generosity of listening, generosity of caring, a huge list. It doesn't necessarily need to default to monetary donations and dana. In the Western culture, it's not uncommon for that to show up in our mind very early on when that word is used. There's so many ways we can open our hearts and minds and be generous, creating a presence and welcoming others. So there is using our agency in support of others. That's a hugely generous act. So generosity in a nutshell is respect to other people and makes it an agent or an actor. And there is a conventional generosity, as Gill says, and in Buddhism, he says, take a look deeper, aided by compassion and wisdom. Why are you going to be generous to something? What does your wisdom factor say in wanting to be generous? And what is the compassion component that enabling you wanting to be generous? The second one, which is the top two are the same in both the lists, Mahayana and Theravada tradition, is virtue. Virtue is stated immediately after generosity, and it's no surprise because when we are in the caring mode or generous mode, our own character plays a significant part on who is the one that is being generous, and that's where the virtue comes in because virtue purifies us as a generous person, and it purifies the recipient as well. So when I was reflecting on this, the two words came to my mind: character versus reputation. Right? Character is what we build for ourselves inside. Reputation is merely what others think of us. It's one definition. Okay. And to quote Jack Kornfield, he said, reputation is a big business. There are billions and billions of dollars in it. We care about how we look, what others think of us. He goes through a big list, right? Whereas the character is the inner silent aspect of how we use our wisdom and compassion to be present in a most virtuous way possible. And there is a component of reflection there is when we are virtuous and reflecting in that area and bring that in the context of three characteristics, particularly not self. Who is that? Who is virtuous? Yes, it is a transient human, transient being at that point, but it is a being that is formed for a particular transaction or a caring or a compassionate act. And that character forms a significant part of that engagement or a service, and that's how virtue is described in this list. The third is renunciation. Renunciation is a complex word. I looked at Audioderma, I looked at Dharma Seed, I look at Be Here Now Network. There are not many talks on this topic. There are talks on generally overall pyramids themselves. And we go into some complex discussion. Renunciation means giving up or taking a monastic life. We just mind wanders off into some extreme definitions of what renunciation means. And the way I understood is there's a component of our attachment or a desire to some of our acts. We are not walking away from life. We are making that grip looser. We are lowering the degree of attachment, and that is the beginning of renunciation. And if we are cognizant of that aspect, we can allow it to unfold wherever that renunciation takes us. It's one of the things I emphasize, the metric for me, because that's how I think. How do I know that I'm a renunciant? Is it lessens my sensual attachment. And whatever lessons means is local to my definition. And how do I really feel about that is my reflection and contemplation. What does it mean? One after renunciation is wisdom, number four in the list, whereas in Mahayana it was number six. And the way Gill explained is renunciation is perfected and purified by wisdom. But they go together in the sense we are wise about how and why we are losing the sensual attachment or. And Gill uses this example of hold a pen tight-fisted all day, see how you feel. If you gently hold it, how you feel, right? And that to me is the entry point of how to appreciate and what role does the wisdom play in not wanting anything at any cost. And an interesting story to share. Last month in June, both my daughters and my son-in-law were in town. Some of you know, I love ecology, nature, all the topics around climate change to the extreme extent. People have choice words for that. I won't go into that. And one of the things my family is obsessed with is global travel. My wife and my daughters constantly want to travel to different parts of the world. They went to Iceland, they went to Norway. 2 weeks from now, they're going to Portugal, Spain. And I didn't join them in any one of these trips. And explicitly, I tell them, I'm happy for you. You seem to be getting joy out of this. I personally don't feel I'm going to enjoy these things as much. I'm happy to travel to come to see you. My daughters, I have a sense of duty, I have a lot of other things. But just to take advantage of hospitality as an industry, it was not a hard thing for me to renunciate that aspect. Right? And we had some serious conversation with my daughters. Do you think then my daughter started asking, are you judging us? Right? And we go into those conversations, but at least I put it out there. And I supported them. What you're doing is a beautiful thing that because you enjoy out of it, I have my inner values supporting me. I'm in this path. I feel I want to be true to my values. So in a broader sense, I can put that under low carbon footprint, no long haul flights. I'm renunciating this to whatever extent I can, but it certainly required some wisdom and compassion on working that issue with my wife and daughters. Thought I'll just share my tiny effort to practice this part of me. Yeah. Right. And wisdom is mentioned over and over as a supporting factor for all of these paramis because That is not a static thing. It's a dynamic thing. We're constantly cultivating more and more of our wisdom, right? The fifth parami is my favorite parami, if I want to call it, is perfection of energy. And when we say we have wisdom or we are applying wisdom, there is a sense of confidence or assertiveness that comes with it, and you can apply that as the energy or virya. They go together. It's applying wisdom with a degree of conviction. There's an energy element that's implicit with wisdom, and cultivating it requires its own, which basically is a critical part of Buddhist training. Is it's not passive religion by any means. And I've seen papers and in Tricycle and others title, Buddhism is not a pacifist religion. Buddhism is not a, a doormat. And they have all kinds of titles, funny titles. But somehow the fact that they had to write the article was concerning to me. Whoever gave the impression that assertiveness is not part of Buddhism, applying our moral values and whatever we believe as a result of being in the path requires a lot of conviction and certainty how we bring that to life. And that's where the energy comes to play. Number six is patience. And I love the fact patience is after energy, because uncontrolled energy can be a runaway truck. Right? And to me, the biggest difference applying wisdom, energy, and patience in that order is really understanding the difference between reaction and response. How our minds jump to a reaction. Even a worst-case scenario, it's even impulse. What wisdom, energy, and patience together allows me is to really assess consequences and the possible outcomes. And patience plays a huge role. And patience and energy support each other. And one without the other becomes unguarded. The seventh is truthfulness. And truthfulness is such a complex topic in the spiritual sense. And the simplest way I would say why it is complex is oftentimes you see there is a relative truth and absolute truth, whatever that means, right? On a day-to-day basis, we don't think along those lines necessarily. At least I'll speak for myself. And the truthfulness, the biggest thing that Gill emphasizes is not to delude ourselves. The second sentence he mentioned is how not to lie to ourselves, stories we tell ourselves, unquote. Because when we get a thought in our mind, as I was trying to guide you through the early part of the meditation, we have a tendency to take the thought, construct into a story or a narrative. Our mind does every second of that. Our wisdom faculty, do you fall for the story or do you examine the story? What part of it is true? What part of it is our own fears, our own conditionality, our own beliefs driving our decisions versus being honest with ourselves and assessing the truth? And I love these three statements, these three short sentences Gill said, how not to delude ourselves, how not to lie to ourselves, and how not to tell stories to ourselves. That's where the truthfulness plays. Number eight is determination, sometimes referred to as resolve. Truthfulness is perfected by determination. And the reason for that, quite simply, is abstinence from falsehood can only happen. We are determined to look at, come on, Ram, don't fall for this thought. Don't really buy into that narrative. I need to be determined to do have that introspection to be able to make that call. It calls for me to be very determined, bring a high amount of resolve into the conversation. And the ninth is loving kindness, which is our favorite topic, which we've had a lot of teachers come and cover that this calendar year. And there's so much in the Metta Sutta. and it is described in detail in Sutta Nipata or in a lot of detail. And to me, loving kindness as a parami is the how, the approach with which we carry through the other eight paramis. And to me, when I'm looking at loving kindness, the adjacent thing for me is to bring in self. Who is that? What am I? Is there a blind spot in me of wanting something and therefore I'm bringing loving kindness? Or am I being completely objective and really be open-hearted and caring for others? Who is that? And can I be that way across everyone? People alike, people who don't like, people who are positive, people who are negative. And so we really have to examine that loving kindness as a parami, independent of who we are bringing that to. Of course, last parami, which is the basis for all of these other nine, is equanimity. Equanimity is not indifference. Equanimity is being present for all experiences and phenomena and applying loving kindness and wisdom in tandem. In a meditative concept, this is where we use the word choiceless awareness. And there's a lot of parallels in our mind state between an equanimous mind and choiceless awareness in the meditative state. So those are the 10. So the couple of words in Pali that comes up quite often is one is called the Svabhava, Svabhava. One way to define that is true nature. Example, the true nature of water is wetness. There's no water if there is no wetness. So in the teachings, when they say these are 10 paramis, when we say we're cultivating, we're not just knowing them, is how do we make this our swabhava? How do we really make this part of our true nature? And that is the work in process. That is the path, right? And the act, once you are taking this 10 paramis and gradually cultivate and make this part of our being called, so it becomes a true nature. And the act that you perform out of that is called swadharma. So which means what comes out of it is truly dharmic action. Looking at the clock here, leave some time for Q&A. So what I learned is while this list has a particular order, we are okay with cultivating in any order. As Gil said in one of his recent talks, just start with one. Right? So that takes the burden out of that, right? And as we develop and express these things more natural way, it does aid our practice, right? The combination of these 10 paramis will support our on-cushion practice. They protect us, they aid us, they support us. And the final comment I want to make is really, this is the core part of the path, how we are going to accumulate merit and wisdom. Is being able to cultivate these paramis. So I will end with Dharmapada, verse 183. Our goal behind the practice is not to do any wrong, cultivate doing good, to purify one's heart. This is Buddha's teaching. Verse 183, Dharmapada. Thank you. Happy to take questions, comments, criticisms, any feedback? Hi.
I always have a question about equanimity, and I like to hear your view on it too, because I always think that equanimity is a result of practicing the other perfections rather than a practice of its own, that I don't just dive after equanimity, but it flows up from the other practices being my true nature. theoretically.
Yeah.
That's how I have always felt about it, because it just has been my experience when I seem to be going well in practice and doing as I wish to follow my values, then I feel more equanimous.
Beautiful, beautiful. Yeah, you're absolutely right. The way you explained it, right? So when I did Brahma Vihara courses with Gil, with Bhikkhu and with the Mahayana tradition, through a Nyingma Tibetan master, or his name is John McCransky. Okay, in Mahayana tradition, when they talk about Brahma Viharas, they start with equanimity, not loving kindness. Right. So there is a way they say that you are cultivating that the path of bodhisattva, of really being that solid personality that is a caregiver. You are willing to delay your own enlightenment before you go to the other. To do that, you need to take away your desires, even for enlightenment, in order to benefit others. So there, equanimity is used as a first parami, or a first of the four Brahma Viharas. On the other hand, in general practice, I'm with you 100%, is equanimity by itself, I could not cultivate it. I was going to different things and coming into equanimity. Because the words in the Western literature, I read neutrality, impartiality, right? And subsiding desire. They didn't really help me much. They really took me more towards indifference. Right. So I had to come back and say, how can I be totally be present with loving kindness and compassion and yet feel equanimous at the same time? Right. So I kind of work myself into loving kindness and compassion as a basis for creating an equanimous heart. And intellectually, mentally, I could not do that. So the conditions I had to create was aided by loving kindness and compassion that allowed me to explore equanimity better. Hope that helps.
Well, thank you for the talk, and thank you for finding enough energy. I'm glad you recovered. And you unpacked a lot of stuff on us tonight. But my wife and I over the weekend decided that we're going to get off all social media, and she added in not watching television, which I was surprised she watches a lot of TV. And we just noticed in a matter of a 24-hour period, just from not consuming this constant I don't know what you want to call it, depending what you're
Yep.
letting in, just how we were more present in the moment and all of those things, the topics that you talk about, you just feel more in the moment, more aware and more present. And it's something that I felt a great appreciation for, just being more in the moment. Normally I come here once a week and it's my escape from all of the constant barrage of, a lot of it is negative information. And it's so true. If you consume it, you become what you consume. And this was a very nice reminder tonight from the talk. So thank you.
Thank you. So it's beautiful the way you phrased it. I reflected on it's not about positive or negative, the information for me. However, there were some sensitive parts in me that I was getting affected by that. Okay. The information is not the culprit by itself. It's my interpretation of how I let it land in me was becoming triggers. Right. And that was the wisdom factor, the best I could call it, that enabled me to explore that further. Ironically, if you go to IMC, there's a bulletin board right next to the kitchen in IMC. They formed a group, how to get away from social media addiction. Right. You're not alone. I think looks like a lot of people are working on decoupling themselves from what they call doom scrolling.
Yes. I was up to 3 hours a day.
Yeah, we are. I mean, I chuckle because us humans are silly people sometimes. You know, we just fall into some of this so easily, and we find ourselves sometimes the smartest thing that you're doing right now is asking yourself why that is the case. That is a beautiful start. That's beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, Ron, I really enjoyed your talk. Thanks. And I loved how you talked about the synergy of the different parties working together so they can reinforce each other. And you gave some good examples of that too, which makes it more easy to practice about what you're talking about. And it just, to me, is very thought-provoking how you can use wisdom to decide how determined I should be about something. You know, I
Yeah.
just really was interested in the synergy of them working together things.
Thank you. I think, yeah, that's exactly right. Buddhist practice is very, very rich, you know. And I hear from many teachers who've been to Burma and Thailand and who trained there many, many years, they shared something in common in many talks. In the West, we start with meditation. In the East, often the starting point of parami is particularly generosity. You go through the training before the teacher decides you're ready for meditation or not. Right? So there are something to be said for creating the mind and heart or purifying the mind and heart before we can sit on the cushion.
I thank you very much. This is a wonderful list to really reflect on. A couple of things that came up for me was because it's a list and we have these tendencies to have certain goals and objectives, at least for myself, one the caution is the use of the words I should or I shouldn't. I think that can get us into this seeking mode and then self-judgment. So if I take renunciation, one could say, I should not or I should give this up. And then if you can't give it up, then that be sort of it's a self-judgment. But I think a better cultivation of that is to come to that renunciation from the point of view of cultivating wisdom, as you said,
Yeah.
wisdom and compassion are the underlying things. So
Yeah.
that naturally becomes a cultivation that arises rather than striving for it. And I think that's one of the takeaways that I have from this.
Yeah.
And the other takeaway is we can look at it from the sort of bottoms up view where we are conscious of these 10 paramis and in our day-to-day life, refer to that and see if our conduct and living is in accordance with these, or we also can come at it from the top-down perspective, because we are all practitioners, and at times, if we are more aware of us being beyond the I, the me, right, just a person, and that we sense ourselves as more of this awareness, then I think it becomes easier to see these parameters just sort of come up within ourselves. So I
Yeah,
think it's
beautiful.
both top-downs and bottoms-up kind of thing. So
Exactly.
those are the two things.
Beautiful. Nicely said that. I think, see, I think you used the word should and shouldn't. I think I remember during one of the retreats, during my practice discussion with Gil, Gil told me, Ram, just remember there are no shoulds in Buddhism. Right? So the idea is, even if you use to your example of renunciation, I'd rather put my energy or my effort on my approach than to be concerned about the outcome. I still have the choice and the wisdom. Is my approach working? Is my energy and effort that I'm making it, is it producing meaningful results? And I'm not tied into success and failure of this effort just because looking at the outcome. However, if I focus more on, okay, I can fine-tune the effort, I can really work on this, I can really change it. So those are all what I could consider them as a wisdom factor, not really be disappointed or whatever from the outcome standpoint. We don't go into the outcomes completely. That's very relating. Okay. Beautiful. Again, thank you so much.